At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tom Brokaw has spent decades taking the pulse of this country and the world as big-time NBC News anchorman and celebrated chronicler of American generations. He's still at it, ambitiously, but the American pulse is a little off these days, he says, maybe more than a little. It's time to think about who we are, what matters, what we want to leave to our grandkids, and what it's going to take to do that. This hour on Point, Tom Brokaw on recapturing the American dream. You can join the conversation. Are we on the wrong track? What got us there? How do we fix it? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Tom Brokaw. He was anchor and managing editor of NBC Nightly News from 1983 to 2004. He's received every major award in broadcast journalism. He wrote The Greatest Generation on the Americans who fought World War II and Boom on the Boomers. His new book out this week is The Time of Our Lives, a conversation about America. Everywhere he goes, he says, he's asked what has happened to us. This book is his answer and more. Tom Brokaw, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hello, Thomas. Good to be back.
Take us back to that moment when you, newlywed, put your stuff in the trunk of your car and headed out, newlywed and rookie journalist, 1962, August 1962. Just for a little perspective on how different, you know, the American vantage is for young people today, what were you looking out on then? You go to it straight at the top of the book.
Well, it was a very exciting time in America for a lot of people of my generation because we had just elected a president that we could identify with demographically. John F. Kennedy was in his early 40s. He was a very dashing man. People often forget, I think, given the rise in income in this country and the spread of wealth, how unique the Kennedys were. They were skiers and sailors and tennis players. That was reserved
jazzy
only
stuff.
For,
mm-hmm.
That's right.
High living.
Those of us in the working class out on the Great Plains had our nose pressed up against the glass of all of that. But I think as much as anything, they spoke to us generationally, that it seemed possible if you were young, you could do the big things in America. And Meredith and I were very taken with the idea of the new frontier and the excitement that the country seemed to have now as part of its calling, if you will. So we went off to Omaha, Nebraska, where I went to work for a very good NBC News affiliate in the newsroom. And because network news, which was just getting started in those days, it was still a 15-minute broadcast for Walter Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley, it was a real meritocracy. You could go from out in heartland America and make it as a network correspondent. That was my early goal. A year later, John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and I broke the news on the NBC station in Omaha. Then I jumped in the car and drove out to the Strategic Air Command headquarters to see what they may have been on alert. Mm-hmm. And my immediate reaction was, I remember this thinking this very vividly, this will change us. I'm not sure how. But the age of innocence for my generation is now over.
So roll forward all these years, and you start right off at the top of The Time of Our Lives with describing how people ask you, and you ask yourself, what happened to the America I knew? In 1962, you said you're newlywed, America investing in a new generation of leadership and promise, John F. Kennedy in the White House, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the march in the South, social evolution going on there, astronauts with the right stuff pointed toward the heavens, women stepping out from behind their aprons, questioning assigned roles, young artists, you write, Tom Brokaw, giving new voice to music, film, and literature. The sense in your youth of the country just bursting, it wasn't by no means all perfect, but bursting with kind of movement on all fronts and forward movement, it felt like.
That's right. It was energetic. It was however you wanted to define the phrase progressive. Even conservatives who were watching all of this and participating in it felt that there were much progress. There was much progress on a lot of fronts, including space exploration. The industrial base was expanding in America. People, my generation, was beginning to live much better than our parents, or certainly our grandparents, who'd come through the Great Depression. Now we find ourselves very acutely polarized in our political culture. We're looking around the world and we see China and India and Russia and Brazil, the so-called BRIC countries that are competitors in a way that we've never had competition before, economically and otherwise. We have this transformative new technology of information technology and cyber technology. We're still unsure about how we're going to use that to the advantage of everyone. But most of all, I think, as a result of this economic downturn, we need to be reexamining our fundamental values. What happened to the idea of saving? What happened to the idea of proportion? What happened to the idea of examining value and how that fits into your life? And most of all, what happened to the idea of having a conversation about this country in which you could stay loyal to your political philosophy or ideology, but be able to listen to the other side and maybe even find some common ground?
You write, as a journalist and fully engaged citizen, we'll talk more about that. You wish there were more of those. But you say, I'm both excited and more than a little unnerved by the magnitude of the changes we have seen. What do you mean when you say what happened to proportion, Tom?
Well, I think the housing situation is emblematic of that. People overreached, built houses that were well beyond what they really needed. They were, in some cases, lulled into mortgages that were well beyond what they could afford. There was that bumper sticker that he who has the most toys when he dies wins. Mm. We got away from what we need, and we concentrated mostly on what we want, without thinking more broadly about the impact of all that. We had the two longest wars in American history fought on credit cards. They've cost a lot more, not just in treasure, but especially in blood, than this country was led to believe that they would. And only 1% of the country is fighting those wars. The other 99% can just turn their back on them. So these cut across the currents that have made America what it is today, and I think that we need to think about renavigation, I suppose, as we plot a course for the future.
You came up in the 50s in South Dakota. We talked about that view from 1962. I mean, did you ever imagine in those days that when you were a grandpa, as your four grandchildren call you now, you dedicated the book to them, that you'd be looking out on a United States of America in this kind of condition, this kind of moment?
No, I guess I didn't. For one thing, I didn't project that far ahead. It was a pretty giddy time for people of my generation. There were opportunities opening up every day. We could live, as I said earlier, so much better in a material sense than our parents did. We traveled more widely than they did. The urban American scene was taking on new forms. We lived in Atlanta and Los Angeles, here in Washington, also in New York. Times were changing all around us. The music spoke to us in a way, even though I was a student of the cool jazz of the 50s, I could see the great appeal of the Beatles and the California sound, the Beach Boys and Joni Mitchell and Neil Young and all the others of the 60s. So we were all swept up in that. But now, you know, as a grandparent, I look at my granddaughters who are 5 and 3 and 15 and 13, and I wonder, what am I going to leave for them? What is going to be what are they going to say when they get to be my age about what we gave them as a place to start?
What's your confidence level? How big are your questions at this moment about what that legacy is
going to be?
I
think the biggest question is, Tom, or the one that I hear most often, is that parents come to me and say, I just worry that our children won't have lives that have been as good as ours. And I'm trying to recalibrate that question in this book and in conversations. In the past, I think that is meant for most families. My children will earn more money than I will. They'll have a grander home. They'll maybe have more cars. They'll be able to travel more. They'll be able to start their own business in a way that I didn't. I think that we probably ought to recalibrate that away from a quantitative equation to a qualitative equation. Let's make the world better for our children in terms of more economic opportunity, in which we have more tolerance, in which we improve the American education system so we can compete with everybody in the world. Let's get back to trying to have a national dialogue about who we are, this extraordinary place that we're all privileged to occupy. We have to think again about the strengths of America as an immigrant nation, which it always has been, and try to have a resolution of that debate that is going on now. These are the kinds of questions that I think that really count.
You're talking about recalibration. A lot of Americans, especially the unemployed, 9.1% plus all the others on the edge of that, you know, the recalibration is so dire that it can feel like a collapse to a lot of people here.
Well, that's why we need to have the recalibration. I've been spending some time looking at the impact of the skill set in America. We've got too many kids coming out of high school who, if they're going on to college, have to take remedial courses in reading and math. Those who are coming out of high school and want to go into the modern workplace are not equipped to deal with that modern workplace in which you have to do problem solving and have computer skills that go beyond just text messaging or tweeting someone. So community colleges are suddenly taking a much more important role in the American educational spectrum because they're training workers for the new demands of the workplace. It's that kind of recalibration that I'm talking about.
It seems, though, that it's also something on the material front. To get out of the McMansions, don't think that that has to be the measure of your success.
Well, you know, home ownership has always been a big goal of the American dream. And then it became almost too easy to sign up to own a home. There were financial institutions that were interest-only for a long, long time, not looking as carefully at credit as they needed to. People with wider eyes than they had pocketbooks bought a home. Both parents went to work trying to keep up with the mortgage payments. And then when the housing bubble burst, those homes went way down in value. The mortgage was still there. So we have that new phrase in American life, homes underwater.
Yeah.
We've got 20 million homes in this country that are either in a foreclosure process or are stressed, as they say, or are in danger of going into foreclosure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today with veteran NBC anchorman and big American observer Tom Brokaw about recapturing the American dream. His new book is The Time of Our Lives, A Conversation About America. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Of course, also author of The Greatest Generation, Boom Voices of the 60s. Tom Brokaw, you write a lot in this book about engaged citizenship. You're really kind of shaking people and saying, wake up, we've got to get busy here. I mean, if you don't know it, one of the chapters is titled Failure is an Option. Hello, wake up.
Right. Well, one of the phrases that I've been using as I go around the country is that it's time for us to re-enlist as citizens. We've got a very active military fighting wars, for example. They've stepped forward. We need to step forward into the political arena or in our communities and identify the problems that are most important to us and begin to take action on them. That's always been the history of this country. We're an activist country. I use two examples about how America was changed in some ways. Candace Leitner was a mother who lost a daughter to a drunk driver. She started something called MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. She did it as a mother in Maryland, and she has changed the way we think about drinking and driving and certainly has changed the laws and social behavior in this country. The most recent one that has been so striking across the country is Nancy Brinker and Komen Race for the Cure. She promised her sister was dying of breast cancer. She would do everything she could to find a cure. You can't watch anything in the fall of the year now, including the NFL, without seeing big, tough linebackers with pink shoelaces or pink chin straps reminding everyone of the need to find a cure for breast cancer. Those are two examples of movements that began and are having a big effect, started by one woman in one case, one woman in another case, with just a determination and a will to do what they promised.
You're looking there at drunk driving and breast cancer, and certainly they've had a big impact in those arenas. We talk about prominence. I mean, right now, a lot of people might look out at the news and say, well, there's an awful lot of Occupy people standing up here. Instead, I mean, last year, Tea Party people. Now people in Oakland just overnight. What about that?
Well, I think that the Tea Party people probably have been more effective in advancing their cause. My line has been about the Tea Party, whatever you think about it. They got angry, they got organized, they got here, and they stayed on message, and they had very specific goals. And so they're driving the debate in the Republican presidential race right now for the nomination to some degree way out of proportion to their numbers. If you look at the macro numbers in America, most people don't agree with all the goals of the Tea Party. But because they do have such discipline and they're organized so well on the internet and in other areas, they are really driving that debate. Occupy Wall Street at this moment is still mostly population. The message is not as clear as it is in the Tea Party.
But it's surely speaking to some of the deep unease that you're describing here. People looking
at it. Oh, absolutely. I understand the rage and the anger of, you know, when they go to Wall Street and say about the banks, you got bailed out and then started paying yourselves bonuses. You got a lot of government money, but you weren't lending it on Main Street anymore. There's something wrong with all of this. But it's kind of across a wide spectrum, the Occupy Wall Street movement. You've got labor members, young people who have been protesting for some time against the economic establishment, a kind of grassroots populism. So at the moment, it needs more definition, in my judgment, to have a long-term impact.
We'll look at where you'd like to see citizens putting their shoulder to the wheel. Look at values first. And you point to, you say, we have threatened core values. Core values under threat, but you enumerate them. Political pluralism is a core American value. Broad-based economic opportunity, threatened, you say. National security secured by means other than the barrel of a gun, you write. Cultural and religious tolerance, all threatened core values?
Well, I think that they are. They've certainly been polarized, and there's very little connective tissue within any of those that you just cited across the spectrum. People simply aren't talking to each other once again about it. I cite a man by the name of John Gardner, who was one of my heroes. He was a Marine veteran of World War II, a distinguished psychologist. He taught at Stanford. He served in Republican and Democratic administrations. He formed something called Common Cause when urban problems were going on in America. I remember when he came to Los Angeles, where we had Watts and a lot of other issues with economic disparity, and he brought together community leaders to begin to address those. And he said, if you have pluralism without compromise, what you really have is tyranny. I also quote Bart Giamatti, who had been the president at Yale, who would say to incoming classes, you're not expected to know, but you're expected to wish to know. And you ought not to leave here hostage to someone else's orthodoxy. I think those are very good guidelines for us to expand across our social and political culture in this country.
What about national leadership? You look a lot at the citizen level, and we will go there. But you also sat down with Barack Obama. This was in Europe, Dresden, Germany, not that long after he took office. He'd given big speeches in Cairo. He'd come to Europe. You sat down with him to talk with the president, and he was talking about our sort of the muscles of our citizenship having atrophied. He said, to you, we're soft in ways that are profoundly dangerous to our long-term prosperity and security. We've got to start working those moral muscles and service muscles and sacrifice muscles a little more. That seems to be in line with Tom Brokaw thinking.
Yes, but then he didn't make it his number one priority when he got to office. He failed to see the toxic effect of the economic downturn in terms of unemployment and what was going on in housing. He expended a lot of his currency on putting together a healthcare reform law that is very complex, and a lot of it won't kick in until 2014. We don't need to revisit that. But I think he understood the problem intellectually. But then it was a question of how do you address it and how do you arouse the country to address it.
You told him, Mr. President, go down and if you get a chance, take a walk through the American Cemetery on the bluff above Omaha Beach, the D-Day landing site there. Why? Why?
I did. I've been there many times, obviously. That was the genesis of me writing The Greatest Generation when I went there to cover the 40th anniversary of D-Day. And I take friends, and when I go back, I always try to take a solitary walk across that cemetery, preferably toward twilight, when you have that great Northern European light playing out across not just those green fields and white headstones, but across the English Channel. And I try to imagine what it was like, not just that day, but to plan that invasion and what was at stake. And if you do it in a solitary sense and get then to the headlands overlooking the beach, almost everyone that I've encouraged to do that is emotionally brought to their knees. And they think back about what in my lifetime happened. I'm 71 years old. I was 4 years old when that happened. And what an enormous challenge that was. But we prevailed, and it was at great cost. But we knew the stakes were big. We don't have that kind of an immediate military threat in this country. But in a way, we are facing a profound challenge of the 21st century about how we position ourselves in the world. And we're going to have to wade ashore once again to try to take the high ground.
Tom Brokaw writes, "The lingering lesson of Omaha Beach is the deeply affecting value of common cause supported by uncommon valor against monstrous tyranny. It is a lesson," he writes, "that need not be reserved for great wars alone." His new book is The Time of Our Lives. He joins us from Washington. Tom, we've got a lot of listeners calling in for you. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air with Tom Brokaw.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well. Hi, Mark. I'm fine.
Hi. I would just like to say that it seems to me that the American dream has vanished because America has stopped investing in its future. Our taxes are at the lowest level they've been since 1950. Our infrastructure is crumbling, and we have a political party that refuses to rebuild it. And it's because the conservative movement has spent decades making war on the entire idea of collective responsibility. And the tools they've used are cutting taxes for the rich and doing and deregulating various industries. That's why we had the housing collapse. It's not the problem we're facing, Tom, is not that too many of the wrong people bought houses. It's that the financial instruments that were used to sell derivatives on those houses crashed the economic system. And that's what put us in this situation. It's hard to remember, but in 2000, when George Bush took office, he inherited budget surpluses as far as the eye could see. The CBO projected that our entire national debt would be paid off by the end of the decade. It was squandered on an unnecessary war in Iraq and tax cuts for the rich. And the result is that income inequality today in this country is comparable to Uganda's. The richest 10% owns 70% of the nation's wealth. And I was extremely disappointed in you, Tom, to hear you attack ARP this week for trying to hold on to the benefits that seniors have earned through a lifetime of work, while you said nothing about the fact that every Republican candidate for president has refused to even consider a deal that would include $10 in spending cuts for every $1 in new taxes. And unless you call out the bankrupt ideology that has destroyed the American dream, you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem.
Tom Brokaw?
Well, that's a polemic. It's not a question.
It's clearly heartfelt. That's
right,
citizen engagement.
Let me address it, Tom, if I can, because I have spoken out against the 10-to-1 question that was raised. And I said that's symptomatic of what's wrong about how people have been driven to the far corners. And when it comes to the housing crisis, it was not just Wall Street. It was also Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which was controlled during those periods of time that you're talking about by Democratic operatives, including James Johnson, who'd been a very powerful member of the Democratic establishment in this country, and a congressman from Massachusetts, Barney Frank, who now acknowledges that more people should rent, that they were pushing too hard to have people buy homes and creating instruments in which allowed them to do just that. I have also spoken out against the idea, and I've said this about Wall Street and Occupy Wall Street now, if Wall Street doesn't reform itself, which it needs to, because it got a government bailout and then immediately awarded itself bonuses, that there will be not just more Occupy Wall Street movements, but there will be much greater restrictions. We can't live without a financial system, but it has to be performed responsibly so that communities and contractors and people who are starting businesses have a place to go and get capital. But it's gotten completely out of whack now for ARP, for the American Association of Retired Persons.
And they've been running TV ads saying, keep your hands off my retirement.
Keep your hands off our benefits. We're 50 million strong. Don't cut our benefits. AARP does not just consist of people who desperately need Medicare and Social Security, and many of them have earned it. I thought, and I said this on the air, that it would have been better for the American Association of Retired Persons to have said, we have so many of our members who are going to need all the benefits that they have earned. We have others, however, who are willing to, for example, increase the retirement age to 67, or to look at means testing for Medicare. Include us in the dialogue. We are living with these entitlement programs. We need to examine them. They are not perfect by any means. Medicare alone, for example, is wildly out of control in terms of what you get and what it costs us for a Medicare patient in South Florida as opposed to what it costs us in Oregon, other parts of the country. There's a desperate need for reform because we can't leave that price tag on the heads of our grandchildren.
Are you saying means test,
before too long paying for it?
Are you saying means test recipients of entitlement benefits, Social Security, Medicare, if they're affluent, they shouldn't qualify even though they paid in?
No, it's not. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that it's not either or. That, you know, I know a lot of people who are wealthy who say, look, I could be, you could benchmark, for example, my Medicare benefits based on my income and what I take and how I take it. We also need to go in and look at how we apply those benefits. Medicare began not for every doctor's visit. It was really to take care of my grandmother. I remember at the time we were a real working class family, and she was living in a county supported facility because she was, we now look back on it, that she was experiencing the onset of dementia or Alzheimer's. And it took everything my parents had to keep that going. The medical establishment in this country thought that Medicare was the socialization of medicine. I was arguing against it as a young man. But the fact is that Medicare needs to be reformed because we can't afford it in its present form over the long haul. And if you don't believe me, you ask a 28-year-old out there in the workplace who said, wait a minute, you know, am I going to have to carry this burden over the long haul? So AARP should be an instrument for reform and for changing and making it possible for it to survive over the long haul. And there's nothing in that ad that says that.
What about our caller's concern that he's seen a push against the power of even the possibility, perhaps, of collective action in this country? I mean, you've written and covered many instances in which big collective action has led this country to do great things, and he sees an attack on that. Do you, and is it a problem? Talk about legacies.
No, I actually believe, and that's the whole purpose of this book. If you want to change things, you've got to build coalitions from the ground up. That's the whole idea. And however much you disagree with the Tea Party, the reason that they're being so successful, as I said earlier, they got angry, they got organized, and they stayed on message and they stayed disciplined. I don't think that they represent in any fashion the vast majority of Americans, but they're playing by the rules, which is that you do get organized. I've been critical of them as well.
What about Wall Street? You mentioned them in the context of the economic collapse. You write a speech in here in your book that you wish you would have heard from one of the executives at the top. Instead of becoming so defensive, you write, you say they were seemingly incapable of saying, this is after the collapses and bailouts and all the rest, incapable of saying, look, this happened on my watch. I screwed up and made terrible decisions. I'm going to spend the rest of my days and a big chunk of my fortune helping those less fortunate. You know, I've had the helicopters and the country clubs and the private planes. None of that gave me the judgment I should have had to head off these economic calamities. Why didn't we hear that speech from really anybody?
Yeah, well, Wall Street is tone deaf. That's why, because they get so intoxicated by the amount of money that they have been able to make. You know, it's the spread is ever greater every year. Warren Buffett has talked about the number of the wealthiest people in America. They're now, it used to be they would be, the 400 wealthiest people would be down in the 50 to 75 or $100 million range. Now the 400 wealthiest people are all in the 200 to $400 million range in America.
Is that tone deafness or something more substantial than just not hearing the music?
Well, I know a couple of instances where major executives in Wall Street firms that got bailed out were told by colleagues and friends, go to a dollar a year for the next 3 years. You've got plenty of money. And they said, well, that would be an admission that we're not doing our job well, because they see compensation as the way that they are measured. I thought that was a huge mistake.
How about the facts on the ground as evidence of a job not well done? I mean, we're all living with that now.
With
the collapse that came right out of many of those practices.
Oh, I don't think there's any question of that, but I think that we're all responsible. I mean, we've got a savings rate in this country that is negative, for example.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with longtime NBC anchorman and American Observer Tom Brokaw about recapturing the American dream. He's writing about it in his new book, The Time of Our Lives, A Conversation About America. It's about a guy who's been watching for a long time, four grandkids now, and really thinking about their future, this country's future, the country they'll live in. Joins us from Washington, D.C. Let's get a call from Dennis, Massachusetts, and Dana. Hi, Dana. Thanks for calling. You're on the air with Tom Brokaw.
Hi. Thank you. Mr. Brokaw, I just feel that a lot of this Norman Rockwell kind of American image you're trying to project, this is what it sounds like to me, it just seems a little bit deceptive in its simplicity. It's really simplistic. It just, you know, like we all should make the sacrifices as citizens when, hey, we didn't cause this problem, Wall Street did. And, you know, we're fighting unjust wars, you know, that are really taxing the American people. And, you know, the sacrifices, in my opinion, should come from the top, the people who caused this crisis. And I also have questions about the role that the Democrats played in the housing crisis. I believe it was done by a lot of bundled loans and were manipulated, and the people at the top were manipulating the average citizen's dreams of owning a house, the so-called American dream. I mean, I would like more critical journalism, not a lot of simplistic mythologizing in service to power, and that's what I feel you do. I'm sorry.
Let me put it to Tom Brokaw. I mean, obviously there were bundled loans and manipulated. Citigroup has said exactly as much and paid. Many others haven't. But Tom Brokaw, what do you say?
A lot of that was driven by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as well. They were, you know, they were encouraging that kind of thing and saying that everybody could own a home when, in fact, it was just financially unrealistic. I'm not excusing what Citibank and the other financial institutions did, but I believe that we were all in. In fact, we went on a consumer binge in this country. I mean, the savings rate now is negative in most households. It was wrong to go in a war on a credit card. There was no question about that. It was also wrong to send less than 1% of our population off to war and not ask anything of the other 99%. When it comes to the Norman Rockwell vision, I've been at this a long time. I'm not naive. I make some very tough suggestions in this book, beginning with, in the state of Massachusetts, the consolidation of a lot of the state agencies and the overlapping agencies that are in your government, as they are in every state in this country.
You're talking about consolidating government, shrinking government? What's your proposal?
Well, what I'm talking about, I don't remember the exact number, but you've got a 911 call center all across the state. You could have two of them, given modern technology, for example. And I know that in Western Massachusetts, there are lots of overlapping water districts, education systems, that you could have more centralized administration. We were all in on this. You know, we just thought the good times would go on forever. And I'm not excusing any part of it, including the top. But what I am saying is that we have to reexamine where we are at the beginning of the 21st century. We're living in a digital world with an analog mentality when it comes to how we organize government and services. And by the way, you know, state and municipal pension funds were investing in those companies that were shipping jobs overseas, and they were the beneficiaries of that until it began to turn around on them. And as a result, a lot of the pension programs in America are under enormous strain. California's got a $14 billion debt deficit that they're facing at the moment. And as you go from town to town to town in California, some of which have had to declare bankruptcy, a lot of that had to do with the very generous benefits that they were providing for their public servants. So that was one more example of everybody in.
Are you saying cut back on benefits for public servants?
What I'm saying is get them more realistic. In Los Angeles, I looked at these numbers the other day. They have 10 people in Los Angeles, beginning with the police chief down to a watch commander, that have retired on a program that's paying them from $325,000 a year in retirement benefits to $200,000 a year in retirement benefits. And that's just mostly in law enforcement and in the waterworks. General Petraeus will retire at a smaller number than that from the United States military. So we have to think about what's appropriate and what's not.
So that's at one end of the scale. I don't want to let Dana's critique of the other end of the scale go quite so easily. I mean, Wall Street had behavior that was so off the hook here that no matter what the government was doing, it took us into a very, very bad place. And talk about $200,000 a year. I mean, that's peanuts in that realm. You know these guys. They live in New York. They may be your neighbors. Are they really taking responsibility for changing it at that end, Tom?
Not enough of them. And I said 3 years ago to a couple of the more responsible Wall Street executives I know that if you people don't begin to reform yourself and begin to say to the country, we should have learned our lessons, I'm telling you, they'll come after you, money marbles and chalk. There were, as I said a moment ago, there were a lot of executives who should have gone to a dollar a year compensation and did not. We just saw this week John Corzine and his fund that has collapsed, and there are millions of dollars that are missing from customer accounts. I mean, I don't know how many more signals that they could have gotten that they've got to change. But as you go across the country, community banks have done the right thing in many instances. They've tried to be responsible to Main Street merchants and to homeowners in other places. That's also part of the financial community, and we ought not to come down so hard on them. It was George Bush, the president, 43, who said that Wall Street got drunk. The question is, who took away the keys? No one did. Regulators were not around. We were allowed to have a Bernie Madoff in the world, for example, to say nothing of the kind of excesses that led to the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Mm. I'm not excusing any of that. Mm. I'm saying that it really has to come from with reform from within. We're not going to eliminate Wall Street. We're going to need financial services in this country. We don't need an economy that has 44% of it now in financial services, which is just trading currency. We're not making things anymore, in part because as consumers, we're demanding ever cheaper goods. So we have to look at the whole picture and not just find one villain and concentrate on that.
Let's go to Nicole in Temple, Texas. Nicole, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Tom Brokaw.
Hey, Tom. What an honor. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a school teacher. I'm 39 years old.
Okay.
I hold a master's degree.
Stay at 36.
I am 39. I keep lying to myself. Mm. I hold a master's degree, and I make less than $45,000 a year. Mm-hmm. My husband holds two master's degrees. He's a production manager at a factory that makes tubs. Makes about twice as much as I do. We have four children, and I'm trying to convince all my kids that a higher education is worth it. But when I look at my husband and what his benefits cost compared to what my benefits cost and what goes into his retirement compared to what goes into my retirement, I'm beginning to wonder, is it really worth it, especially with the cost of education rising and the loans becoming even more scarce and you have to pay them back? And I'm just curious.
Is it worth becoming a teacher, do you mean, Nicole? Going into teaching, is that the question, Nicole?
Well, no, my question is,
just education,
the state of higher education, is it even worth it anymore at the rate that loans are becoming, aid is becoming scarce, loans are, our kids end up with millions of dollars of loans, and my husband works at a plant and makes fabulous money.
Tom?
Well, here's what I think. First of all, I'm encouraged that the idea of changing American education is finally in the public arena, and people are beginning to talk about merit pay for teachers, good teachers getting $80,000, $90,000 a year because they're that important to our society. When it comes to higher education, I think your children probably are going to be part of a new generation that will look at it in a more targeted way. What am I getting out of it besides just a broadly based education that I can take to the marketplace? I said earlier in this broadcast that you're seeing more community colleges now exploding across the country because they're teaching the skill set that the modern marketplace requires. That's one more example of the kinds of reforms that we should be thinking about. And as you go across the country, I believe that you can have a lot more consolidation of the administration cost in not just public elementary, secondary education, but also in higher education, that we need to become into the 21st century on that.
You're talking about consolidating some state universities and colleges. Maybe what, having fewer or consolidating administration? Sounds like you want more efficiency.
I think you can have as many campuses, but I think you can do a lot more online. You can have a more centralized administration. You can have regional medical schools, for example, instead of every state trying to support two or three medical schools. These are the kinds of hard decisions that we're going to have to make in America.
Is that dropping our sights or just getting real? How do you describe it?
No, it's not dropping your sights. It's raising your sights. It's getting more quality, getting a bigger bang for the buck. It's moving into the 21st century. You know, the countries that we're competing with are now beginning to reinvent on an open field. We have primarily a political and educational system in this country that was designed at the beginning of the 20th century. We need to move into the 21st century and have much more efficiency built into the system.
Keith in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. You're on the air with Tom Brokaw.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I really just wanted to say that, you know, the reason I see the American dream going down the toilet right now is the lack of responsibility, personal responsibility in this country. We have too many individuals working to have someone take care of them rather than actually working. And I'm just wondering, what's it going to take for everyone to open their eyes and just be able to wake up and say, hey, I need to go to work. I need to, you know, take care of my things so that overall things will become better.
But Keith, what about when there are not jobs?
Well, the problem with not having jobs is because people won't go out and look for jobs. There's enough people just sitting on their butts at home instead of, you know, I'm sorry, if there's a job at McDonald's, go work at McDonald's.
Well, I have to
say, no job is too low when you don't have a job.
I hear you, but I've seen the lines just around the block of people looking for jobs. Tom Brokaw, what do you say to Keith's perspective?
Well, I think it's, with all due respect, I think it's too simple to just say people are sitting on their butts at home and not looking for work. People are looking for work, and it's the kind of work that used to be available in America that's not so available anymore. I went out to do a story about a community college in northern Kentucky that serves the industrial area of that part of the state and also Ohio. And there was a 28-year-old who was being trained in the new systems that are required in hydraulics and computers and so on. I saw off to the side, however, two guys who were just sweating bullets. They'd been there for a year. One was a former forklift driver in a warehouse, and the other one was a long-distance truck driver. Their jobs had disappeared. Were they going to be able to adapt to the demand of the new economy? It was going to be very tough for them. So that's something that we have to think about. I do think a lot of this will change generationally. I think the neo-frugalists, as they're called, the millennials, they're looking at life in an entirely different way. They're replacing what I want with what I need. And that has to be part of the national dialogue.
Samantha in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm 23 years old, and I just feel like my age group, my generation, has lacked since I've read your Greatest Generation books, and we're just completely different. And I think the future is going more to not getting news from actual sitting down and watching the television and more Facebook and via on the internet. And I wanted to know what you think we should do.
Well, I was asked a simple but profound question when I was at Stanford recently by a law student who said, have we lost the real meaning of friend in our generation? Because we use it so casually, and we've made it into a verb. We're friending someone. This new technology is exceptional. It is transformative. But it ought not just to be a means of communication back and forth across social lines or a form of entertainment. We ought to be able to use it to advance our political, our economic culture, certainly healthcare in America, and we need to have a dialogue about that. It exploded on us, and we just kind of found our way, and we were mesmerized, as I have been, by all the new apps that are out there and the tools that are available and the ability to stay in touch with each other. But what is the long-term goal here? We should be thinking about that a little more, I think.
You write a lot about dialogue, about American dialogue, and the need to have it across lines. Why do you think it's become so polarized? How do we get out of that and get back?
Well, I think it's become polarized in part because there's a lot of money that's available to fund very narrow special interests. That ranges all the way from Wall Street interests down to populist interests. And that becomes the litmus test then. And they apply that litmus test to the public arena. So they take the measure of someone who comes into that arena by whether or not they'll serve their very narrow special interests. They're not looking for a broadly based candidate. So the candidates in turn then become hostage to all of that. Secondly, there's a kind of, if you will, cyber tyranny that exists. If someone says something that bloggers don't agree with, wherever they come from, the political arena or from sports or anything else, the screen lights up. I mean, every member of Congress now and every member of the Senate has someone who does nothing but track all day long what is being said about their office holder, their boss in the House or in the Senate across political lines. And that doesn't allow for the kind of space that we need to learn how to listen to each other and not just shout at each other.
You say listen and let's get busy. There's a real urgency in this book, Tom, that the time for to build the future is now, you write, that we'll have fewer ideal opportunities to reignite the American dream as time rolls on. How about that urgency?
Well, I think there is great urgency because everything moves at warp speed. Greece gets a cold, we get the flu. I mean, that's a perfect example of what's going on. It moves markets when something happens because we're so connected around the world in our economy and what our interests are, and people are moving in ways that they have not in the past, and we have to catch up to that.
Will we do it?
Listen, I'm a product of working class America. I came from a small town in South Dakota to the life that I have today and the resources that I have, but I've never lost my feel for Main Street and the great work that is going on out there by people doing it in their communities, in their small businesses, in their families. We just have to become once again more than the sum of our parts, not less than the sum of our parts. And that means that Wall Street has to learn to work with the common man, and the common man has to develop a kind of idea about what's possible, what's proportional. What does the American dream mean in terms of values? And I think if we have that kind of discussion in the course of the next year, we'll make some important steps.
And to be fully engaged citizens, Tom Brokaw writes in his new book, The Time of Our Lives, A Conversation About America. Tom, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.